we do what we can. So today I'm going to tell you about the holographic entropy cone. Apologize to those of you who have heard a version of this talk before. Luckily, I think it may be just Will, so that'll be okay. This is a work with myself, Hirose, Bogdan Stoica, Caltech, and Sepper Nazemi, James Sully, and Michael Walter at Stanford. In particular, Bogdan is graduating this year, so I encourage you to look out for him when application season rolls around. So before I can define what the holographic entropy cone is, I feel that I should first define what an entropy cone is. And to define what an entropy cone is, I need to first tell you some facts that are in general true for all entanglement entropies. So for all quantum states, entanglement entropy obeys a certain set of inequalities, namely positivity subadditivity, the Iraki-Lieb inequality, strong subadditivity, and weak monotonicity. So, a historical fact, which will actually end up being useful for this talk, the most recent of these inequalities was proven in 1973. So these are the inequalities that are known to be true of this form, which are linear combinations that are not conditional. By conditional, I mean entanglement inequalities that are true if some other condition is true. Like, for example, there are additional inequalities that are true if strong subadditivity is saturated. We're not talking about inequalities of that form. We're talking about these unconditional, if you will, inequalities. These are the only known unconditional inequalities that are true for all quantum systems. So one thing that you can immediately do after you define a set of inequalities that's true for all quantum systems is you can ask how these constraints divide up the phase space of available entanglement entropies for quantum systems. And you can do so in the following way. So you can define a 2 to the n of minus 1 dimensional space where n is something called the party number, where n is the number of elements in, say, A, B, C, D, dot, 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 the number of parties. So for example, if I were looking at inequalities of this form, I would say that the party number here would be 3. Sorry for being pedantic, but this is somewhat necessary. So you can define a 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional space where the axes are S of A, S of B, etc. So the entanglement entropy of every possible combination of subregions. The reason why it's 2 to the n minus 1 is because the entanglement entropy of the null set is always taken to be is always 0, so we can ignore that dimension for simplicity. Now, once we have this space...
Sorry, does that make it 2 to the n minus 1, or it's 2 to the n minus 1?
I think I was right the first time. Yeah.
That is your explanation.
Go ahead. Yeah. I overcorrected. So now, if we define such a space, these inequalities become half spaces on this space, where the half spaces are covered by codimension 1 surfaces that correspond to when these inequalities are saturated. And we can define a cone, so that we can define the entropy cone, or an entropy cone, I should say, is the intersection of true inequalities. So we can intersect these half spaces, and the intersection of the half space of the half spaces defined by all true inequalities is going to be a constrained part of this full entanglement entropy phase space that was initially available to us. And the reason why it's a cone is because all linear inequalities of this form that don't, you may notice that none of them have some arbitrary constant that's not zero that is added to the entanglement inequalities. So it's pretty easy to see that all of them are saturated at the origin of this 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional space. And we have positivity and these other things. So what they do is they define a cone whose apex is at the origin and whose base is a polyhedra that extends out to infinity. So this is why we call it a cone. I should point out that once we define an inequality, once we define a cone that is the intersection of true inequalities, this is not sufficient to show that that cone is the true entropy cone of states of that type. So for example, in this case, we define inequalities that are the inequalities that are true for all quantum states. It is not sufficient to simply intersect these cones in all permutations thereof, some of which are each other, to say that that is the full quantum entropy cone. Indeed, it's only sufficient to say that the true quantum entropy cone is contained within this cone. We can show that this cone is at least as large as the quantum entropy cone, but we can't show that this cone is at most as large yet. So in order to demonstrate that this cone is at most as large, we can appeal to convex optimization, and we can look at the extremal rays of the cone. So the extremal rays are defined as the dimension 1 intersections of these half spaces that form the convex hull of the cone. And what we can get is that these extremal rays, we can ask if we can find a state that's not at the origin on each of the extremal rays, because obviously they all contain the origin, that on which we can construct a quantum state that has the same entanglement entropy structure as the ray. What do I mean by that? Well, each extremal ray can be defined parametrically in the following way. I can define the entanglement entropies as, for example, k, C1 times k, C2 times k, et cetera, et cetera, where the k will parameterize this one-dimensional ray that I'm talking about in the 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional space. If I can construct a quantum state that exists on that ray that saturates all of these things while fixing k to be some non-zero value, then that's sufficient to show that extremal ray is what we call a constructible extremal ray, that we can construct a quantum state that lives on that extremal ray. If we can construct a quantum state that lives on each extremal ray, then through interpolation, we can show that we can construct the exterior, we can construct the exterior boundary of this cone. So that's sufficient to prove that the cone is, that the true entropy cone is at least as large as this cone. Because we previously showed that it was at most as large as this cone, this sandwiches this down to the true cone, as long as the constraints are linear, and so far the constraints that we know for entanglement entropy are linear. So where does this leave us? Well, it's known for quantum systems. So if we're looking at quantum entropy cones, the two-party and three-party quantum entropy cones are fully specified. Indeed, they're specified by exactly these inequalities, the two-party specified by the first three. And in order to specify the three-party inequality, we need to add the subsequent two. We find that the intersections defined by all permutations of those inequalities, sufficiently generalized, define this cone. And indeed, we can construct a quantum state that lives on each extremal ray of this cone. Now,
because of the assumption that the implementing the system on a lattice, the movable number of states.
That's right, for the quantum states.
You are assuming that.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll get back to that point. But in general, what you say is correct.
Sure. Why doesn't it apply to continuum theories?
Well, you know, continuum theory is the area of the region that's on some curve, for example.
Could be.
A lot of curves. There are even more curves than there are points. So. Here is clearly denumerating everything, assuming it's denumerable for the general. That's necessarily the case for a continuum theory. Except there's a limit of
I'm not sure if I agree with that statement. The statement that I thought you were making is that the examples that you're finding for the extremal states, for the quantum states, are indeed these qubit states, where, for example, I can find that the GHZ state lives on.
This is all you've given the arguments for the numerable. You're making some assumptions about
the continuum limit. Yeah, that's true. Okay. So for the two-party and three-party case, the cone is known to be known. It's given by those inequalities, and you can construct quantum states that live on each extremal ray. But you immediately run into problems when you look at the four-party cone. And the reason why you run into problems when you look at the four-party cone is that these inequalities plus generalizations thereof, say if I replace one of the variables, say C, with, for example, CD, and do permutations thereupon, you find that there are 8 families of extremal rays that are where each family is defined as an extremal ray and all permutations thereupon of the extremal ray. 6 of them are constructible, but 2 of them are actually provably unconstructible by any quantum state. So this leads you to believe that probably one of two things is true regarding the four-party cone. The first possibility, and the possibility that I'm going to take to probably be true for the remainder of this talk, is that we need more inequalities that are true for all quantum systems. So this is the viewpoint that I'm going to take.
I'm sorry, all those inequalities only have three parties, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So when you say that there's this proof for the four-party cone, what inequalities are you using to define the cone?
Oh, good. So for example, these three-party inequalities, I can generalize to four-party inequalities by, for example, replacing this B with BD. And then this inequality would become S of ABD plus S of BC D is greater than or equal to S of BD plus S of ABCD. So this would be taking a three-party inequality and extending it to a four-party inequality.
I see. But these are the lists you're working with so far.
That's right. Because these are the only inequalities that people know how to prove for all quantum systems. So we find, again, that...
So saying in the four-party case, you say...
So for the four-party case, there are 8 families of extremal rays. 6 families are constructible, and 2 families are provably not constructible by any quantum state. So what this means is that we need to... This is not a proof that that I have worked out. This is a proof that is stated in the information theory literature.
How do you prove something that's not true for any quantum?
You can show that in order to construct any of... I actually don't remember the details, but I can get back to you later on this.
That sounds fascinating because a lot of quantum physics. So you must use something about any quantum physics. What do you use?
I don't remember, but I can get back to you on
that. It's not just true for any quantum physics.
So the other possibility, which I mentioned for the sake of completeness, is that it's possible that the four-party cone does not contain its boundary, or some portion of its boundary, where some of the extremal rays do not need to be contained by the inequality, because perhaps you can approach them asymptotically, you just can't get the exact ray. For the purposes of this talk, I will ignore this possibility and focus primarily on this one. So if we need more inequalities, the obvious thing to do is to ask to try to prove more inequalities. But because quantum mechanically proving further inequalities just sociologically has proven to be difficult, in the sense that no one has managed to prove any new ones over the past 40 years.
Is this an issue of proof, or are there conjectures of further inequalities?
There are conjectures of further inequalities that no one knows how to prove.
OK.
Yeah. So.
Oh, I was going to ask one quick. So the four-party inequalities you're considering are just the ones gotten from generalizing these three-party ones?
That's right. So you might think that, okay, the way out is to find a new four-party inequality and prove it. And indeed, there are candidates. One of them is an inequality known as the Zhang-Yung inequality, which is believed to be true for all quantum systems, but nobody knows how to prove it. So it's complicated to write down.
If I assume that the system is Lorentz invariant, then they are more inequalities. If the system is Lorentz invariant, then they are non-linear inequalities for entropies.
That's right. But currently, I'm focusing on all quantum systems, so I'm not restricting by Lorentz invariants.
Okay.
Right. So these inequalities are difficult, but as Tarun hinted to, if you restrict the set of systems that you're considering down further, perhaps additional constraints can find entropy cones and thus further inequalities that are true for those restricted sets of systems and not, for example, for all quantum systems. So in particular, as the title of my talk may be served to give away, I'll be focusing on holographic systems. As the majority of the room, I believe, is at least passingly familiar with holography, I'm going to tell you that the primary ingredient of holography that I'm going to be using is the Ryutaki-Inagi formula, which says, basically, that S is equal to the area over 4G, where this is the area, I'm going to write this out because it ends up being important, of the minimal surface subtending A. So the entanglement entropy of some interval on the boundary is given by the area of the minimal surface that subtends it. You can immediately see, I believe, that this is a quite powerful statement, because as you can see from before, I wasn't even able to fully articulate the ways in which you prove the ways. Sorry, I wasn't even able to fully articulate the ways that you can prove that certain families can't be constructed quantum mechanically, because the articulation thereof is not straightforward. It's not simple. But what this immediately does is this transforms questions about entanglement entropy from a question in abstract linear algebra to a question about geometry. So what this does is, for example, this tells me that if I have an entanglement entropy inequality of this form that I want to check whether or not it's true, where I have a sum over positive coefficiented left-hand side inequalities is greater than or equal to the sum of positive coefficiented right-hand side inequalities, it is sufficient to prove that I can take the minimal surfaces that subtend the left-hand side inequalities and cut and reconnect them in such a way such that they form non-minimal covers of the minimal surfaces of the right-hand side geometry. If I can do that, and if I can cover every single element on the right-hand side geometry, then I know that I have a true inequality. This is a much better state of affairs than for generic quantum systems, in which people even know what they're trying to prove and have no idea how to prove it. So following this method, let me just give you a very simple example. Again, this is an example, so it's not meant to hold in all generality. Let's consider how one would prove subadditivity in this picture. So subadditivity S of A plus S of B are subtended by these two minimal surfaces, and S of AB is this minimal surface, it's immediately clear that that the minimal surface that subtends S of AB is that the interval AB is non-minimally covered by S of A plus S of B. So it's immediately true that subadditivity holds for this specific configuration. Now, this is perhaps a little bit too glib, because in order to see that this is true for all systems, I have to consider many, many different possibilities where, for example, A and B could be adjacent to each other, could be not adjacent to each other. They could be of relatively different size. And the minimal area, for example, if A is here and B is here, for example, there's a question of whether this is the minimal surface that subtends the two, or this is the minimal surface that subtends the two. So there are these questions that you have to address in general, but let me promise you that if you do it in full generality and you do the exhaustive case enumeration, you indeed see that you can prove geometrically that, for example, subadditivity is true. But we're not in this any questions? Okay. We're not in this enterprise simply to holographically reprove inequalities that are known to be true already for full quantum systems. So indeed, in 2011, Hayden, Hedrick, and Maloney showed that the first inequality that's true for all quantum systems is true. That inequality is something that they call monogamy of mutual information, and it has the following form. So this inequality, again, is true for all holographic systems, but is not true for all quantum systems. In particular, if you look at the four-party GHZ state and you calculate all of these entanglement entropies, all of them would be 1 or the same. So you would get that 3 is greater than or equal to 4 for the four-party GHZ state, which is not true, which already gives you the interesting corollary fact that you cannot construct the GHZ state holographically. But for those of you to which that is not impressive, let me just show a schematic depiction of how one proves this inequality. Again, this is just an example. I can draw the minimal surfaces that subtend the left-hand side. This would be this one, and just to break the symmetry, I'll say that SAC is this one, so this surface plus that surface, and then I'll draw the right-hand side, partitioning of the same, which will be these three plus this one. I see that this is the same as this. This is the same as this. So all that remains is to consider these two regions and these sets of regions that partition it. We can see that we can cut and re-glue this region at this point. I'll put a double line to differentiate it from the above, where we can take this curve, this portion of this curve, and glue it to this portion of that curve. So we get what looks like a hook. And on this side, we get the same hook. And we see that these hooks both non-minimally subtend A and C, respectively. So what this shows is that for this particular configuration, this entanglement entropy inequality is true. So again, through exhaustive case enumeration, you can show that this is true for all systems, for all holographic systems. But you may have noticed that I've said exhaustive case enumeration a lot. And doing things by exhaustive case enumeration is not something that, in general, you want to do, because though it might work for 2 and 3 parties, once you get higher, the combinatorial factor will make it grating to continue to do things that way.
So you said that this was violated in quantum mechanics.
This is violated
by what, the GHZ
state? Yeah. Sure. So the GHZ state is a state of the following form. So this is the GHZ state. And what this may secretly be telling us, or at least what McCund tells me that he thinks that this is secretly telling us, is that holographic entanglement entropy really fundamentally cares about bipartite entanglement entropy more than genuine multipartite entanglement entropy, because you might notice that if we take the projection of this down to bipartite entanglement entropy, it doesn't really have all that interesting properties. Which is an interesting idea, but not an idea that I will focus on very much for the remainder of the talk. Yes?
Can you characterize these special states that satisfy Reach Gagne?
Sure.
Just in the quantum mechanical language, we know there are these states that satisfy this inequality, and we're saying, well, there are states that have a holographic dual. But suppose I wanted to say that only from the quantum mechanical perspective. Is there just some conditions on quantum states that will allow you to prove that monogamy
of mutual information?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have two answers to that question. Okay. The first answer to that question is that if you're asking the question of, given a particular field theory, if I can figure out always whether or not it has a classical gravity dual, which is what we mean when we say that a theory is holographic in this context, if you figure out how to do that in general, you should let me know, because as far as I know, this is still an open question. Joe Polchinski here has written down some necessary conditions, but unfortunately they're not sufficient conditions. So the necessary conditions have to do with gaps in the dimension of the spectrum of the dimension of conformal operators, and the largeness of the central charge of the conformal field theory. But they're not known, it's not known whether or not they're sufficient, and I think, in fact, it's believed that they're not sufficient. Now, the answer to your second question, the answer to the second interpretation is whether it's possible to prove that such inequalities are true for generic systems, for systems that obey a different set of constraints. The answer to that question is somewhat surprisingly yes, but in order to explain why that's true, I'll have to get through more of the talk. So I'll get back to that answer later. Okay, great. Any other questions at this point? All right. So, as I said, exhaustive case enumeration is exhausting. So one thing that we can do is we can do a procedure called inclusion-exclusion. Where inclusion-exclusion is defined as the following. So let me use the right-hand side figure because it's a little bit simpler of an example. And what I can do here is I notice that this partitions this into five regions. In general, for three things, it will partition it into 2^n regions. But we can identify each region by whether it's contained in each minimal surface or whether it's not contained in each minimal surface. So for example, out here, this we can write down as the intersection of the complement of A, because it's not an A, with the intersection of the complement of B, with the intersection of the complement of C, with the intersection of the complement of ABC. So equivalently, I can write this suggestively as four zeros. This region is contained only in the complement of ABC and not in the rest, so I can write this as 0, 0, 0, 1. This one I can write as 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, and 0, 0, 1, 1. So this is what people mean when they talk about inclusion-exclusion. They mean that we can identify the different regions of the bulk and the different pieces that they correspond to with whether or not they are contained or not contained within the minimal surfaces within the other minimal surfaces. I can identify, now at this point, you notice that these are ordered, these are binary ordered n tuples where n, so ordered binary n tuples, where n is the number of entanglement entropy terms of the side of the inequality that you're trying to consider. So for example, these four indices correspond to the four terms of the right-hand side of this inequality. So I would say that these are the right-hand side ordered n tuples. And because they're ordered binary n tuples, it's possible to map these ordered n tuples to the vertices of a hypercube And so, in mapping it to the vertices of a hypercube, what you have done is you've converted what was even a geometry problem, but a geometry problem that you needed to do through exhaustive case enumeration, into a mapping question of whether or not there exists a mapping between the left-hand side hypercube to the right-hand side hypercube. Now, obviously, for generic hypercubes, I can draw any region and there will exist such a mapping, so there needs to be an additional condition that restricts to that tells you whether or not the holographic inequality is true. And interestingly enough, it can be shown that this condition reduces to a Hamming distance on the hypercube, where if we can show that for all points that are part of the left-hand side hypercube, x and y, if the Hamming distance between x and y is always greater than or equal to the Hamming distance between what x and y are mapped onto, then the inequality is true for all holographic systems. So you can show. So there's two ways to think of Hamming distance. That's one way. Another way is to just ask how many digits are different between the ordered n tuples. It's the same thing. Yeah. So this step is not very difficult to do. The sensitive step is why inclusion-exclusion is important. And the intuition for why inclusion-exclusion is important is that you can think of inclusion-exclusion as a way of manifestly telling you what kinds of cuts and re-glues are necessary in this sort of mapping. All right. So now that I've stated a way, did you, sorry?
I'm just wondering, the equal sign is the same as the, you know, for the inequality, the Hamming distances are the same?
Yeah, it's fine if it's inequality. So now we have a way to prove whether holographic inequalities are true. But you may notice that the proof method is not particularly constructive. So unless you have, say, a large reservoir of candidate inequalities, which ironically you do in the quantum case, but you don't necessarily have in the holographic case, this isn't really useful unless you're just particularly adept at guessing the structure of holographic entanglement entropy inequalities. But luckily,
sorry, you said ironically you do it in the quantum case.
So right, so this was this Zhang-Yung inequality that I was mentioning.
That's a large reservoir.
There are generalizations of Zhang-Yung. There's in fact an infinite class. So you could try this for all of those, but these are not, I think all of those actually trivially pass this test. But they're in some sense not interesting for a reason that I'll explain in a second. So we have this non-constructive proof method, but in order to make it useful, we now need a way to generate, in general, the candidates for these inequalities to give to the proof method. So in order to talk about how we generalize these, I want to return to what I was saying in the beginning about extremal rays.
So is it true that,
yes,
any conceivable inequality that's linear like this is mapped on the...
No. There are definitely inequalities that fail this condition. For example, if I take one of the ones that's known to be true for quantum mechanics, and I just switch all of the coefficients, it fails this test.
I didn't read this first.
Like, for example, if I say S of A is always less than or equal to 0, it fails this test. That's not true for all. So
it fails what test? It can't be converted to this.
It does not have this Hamming distance mapping property.
So how did you prove that this property works for all Are you saying anything geometric and holographic will have this form?
That's right.
I see.
And but he would, I guess Professor Gross was asking if any linear combination has this property, and that's not true.
And so you're saying if I just change some of these signs, I cannot turn that into a possible property of a holographic system?
I'm saying area is negative, you can't turn it into a holographic.
I'm saying that if you change some of the signs, you'll end up showing that you will end up finding no such Hamming contraction.
I know, but I'm confused what that means. Does that mean that if I change the sign, I can prove that it can't be an inequality that holds for holographic systems?
No. No,
it means, so it can't be addressed by this included.
It can't be proved in this way, is what it means. Okay. So we have not yet demonstrated that this way of proof is in fact exhaustive, and as I will mention later, I hope that it's not exhaustive.
Great. Even in the holographic case.
Even in the holographic case. So in order to address this question of constructing candidates, we talk about extremal rays, but now from the perspective of holography. In holography, I can't just write down some arbitrary sum of kets and say, oh, look, here's a state, now let me calculate its entanglement entropies, and so this is a holographic state. For example, if I did that, then I would conclude that the GHZ is a valid holographic state, whereas we know that the GHZ state for four parties violates this inequality. So how do we do this? Well, it turns out that the way that you end up doing this is using graph theory. So if, for example, I have n parties, as before, I can consider a complete graph that has n minus 1 vertices. And so I will draw this for n equals 4, just because higher things challenge my artistic abilities. This is the complete graph for n equals 4. And then I will append onto this complete graph an external edge that goes to 5 additional points, which I will label to be the parties. And the additional one I'll label as the complement. Oh, so I need this complement 1 because otherwise f of a, b, c, d will always be 0. And so I'm interested in entanglement entropy properties that are not always 0. And at this point, what I do is I leave the coefficients of every single edge, the edge weights of every single edge here, as a variable. So I leave them general. And then what I do is, if you remember from before, extremal rays can be specified in the following way as a vector. With a bunch of ratios, I can fix k to be without loss of generality 1. And then what I can do is I can ask whether or not I can satisfy a condition such that the minimal edge weight across cuts that isolates, for example, if I'm interested in S of AB, that isolates A and B from the remaining systems, you may notice that cut can be this one, or this one, or this one, or this one, and there are others. If you can show that you can satisfy all of these terms for a cut like this by putting in specific values for the edge weights internal to this, then you've successfully constructed a holographic state that has the property that the entanglement entropies are in fact given in this set of ratios. The reason to think about this is kind of like inverting the initial process of going from Feynman diagrams to string diagrams. Instead of if we think about this as a sort of graphical representation like a Feynman diagram, and if we think about fattening each of the legs, and if we think about fattening each of the legs by prescription of the edge weights that are on each of the legs, then, for example, a graph that looks like this will go to a multi-boundary wormhole geometry that looks like this. And as long as we take each of the legs to be long enough, then what we can do is we can see that by Ryu Takayanagi, the entanglement entropies, for example, S of A will correspond to this homologous distance, S of B will be, for example, this one, and S of C will be this one. And so the edge weights actually exactly parameterize allow us to exactly parameterize where the minimal cuts that give you the entanglement entropies of different sets of the boundary surfaces are. So interestingly enough, if we can, for certain extremal rays, construct a graph like this, we can immediately transfer that graph picture into a geometry picture and show that those extremal rays are what we call holographically constructible. So using this method, I believe. Right. So what you can do, so this picture is easiest to see in 2 plus 1. But you can actually extend it to higher dimensions, which is something that I wasn't planning on focusing on, but I can mention briefly by, for example, tensoring n minus 3 sphere at every point in the space. Or, if you will, you can have some higher dimensional Riemann surface in many dimensions, though I can't really draw that. And then you can just consider adding handles that correspond to these cuts, and then the cuts end up being across the handles. So that method is possible, and we discuss it in our paper, but it wasn't going to be the focus of the remaining time that I have in this talk. So what you can see is that if you take this inequality that was known to be true, plus the inequalities that are known to be true for quantum states, and you construct the cone using those inequalities, you end up getting something like 26 families of extremal rays. And you end up finding that, I believe, 19 of them are constructible. And the remaining 7 are not constructible in this way. Now, if they're not constructible in this way, as Don maybe alluded to before, there are two possibilities. One is that we weren't smart enough to figure out the way to prove exhaustively whether things were constructible. And the other is that they're actually not constructible and we need new inequalities. So for what systems do we need new inequalities? If I may backtrack a little bit. So holographically, the 3 and 4 party case are done. All we need for this is the monogamy of mutual information inequality that I just erased, plus the known quantum inequalities. So those are enough to specify that. And the 26 and 19 number that I talked about before is for the case of 5 parties, where what we find is that those inequalities are not sufficient. So again, we use that to, we take that to mean that we need additional inequalities. But unlike the quantum system, where it seemed hopeless, now we have this nice geometrical way to search for these, to look for these inequalities. Sorry, let me rephrase that. Now we have this nice geometrical way to prove these inequalities. I still haven't told you how we search for the inequalities. And the way that we search for the inequalities is, apologies, it may seem somewhat simple-minded, but what we do is we take some set we take a generic entanglement entropy inequality like this, and we vary the coefficient ci from, say, negative 2 to 2. And then what we do is we demand that the inequalities that we see, that we choose to be our candidates, are not violated by any of the constructible extremal rays. But also, in order to make sure that they're interesting, that they in fact exclude one of the extremal rays that we are not able to construct. So this gives us a restricted list, actually a quite restricted list for 5 parties, initially, for the extremal rays that for inequality candidates. And now that we have inequality candidates, now the fact that this is non-constructive no longer matters. We can put it through the system, and we can ask a computer program, for example, to search whether or not there exists Hamming contractions of this form. And if there does exist that, congratulations, you've proven a new holographic inequality. Now, what we've done here is basically specified an industry that we can do. And like any good person who runs an industry, now I can draw a flowchart, where what we do is initially we slice the cone with known inequalities. So this will give us some cone. Then we check to see whether extremal rays are constructible. Then we take the extremal arrays that are not constructible and the extremal arrays that are constructible, and we use that to search for more inequality candidates. And then we check whether those inequality candidates are true using the Hamming method. And when we find an inequality that's true, then we iterate. And we slice the cone again until we find that all extremal arrays are, in fact, constructible.
So you found new inequalities, right?
Yes.
So they have a nice geometric cone.
Well, I'm about to talk about that. So we can do this. And the punchline, or I guess what I kind of think is a punchline, is that for 5 parties, you find 5 new holographic inequalities. Which you can use the Hamming distance method to prove are true for all systems. Now, unfortunately, these 5 new inequalities are not quite sufficient to close the 5-party cone. You end up seeing that there are still 2 families of extremal arrays. That are remaining that we don't know how to construct. We, in fact, have candidate inequalities that will remove these 2 further extremal arrays that we found through this search process. But unfortunately, for those extremal arrays, we can't prove them using the Hamming distance property. Strangely, well, so I'm personally not sure whether the reason why we can't prove them is because of simply computational limitation, because this is computationally expensive, or if it's because, as Don was asking before, if this proof method that we're looking at is in fact not exhaustive. It's not clear to me which one of those it is. If my personal inclination is probably actually to lean towards the latter, because we've tried things that various slight modifications of the inequalities, say, for example, doubling both sides of the inequality and doing things like that, and those don't seem to get us any farther. So it seems like perhaps there needs to be additional methods in order to prove these remaining inequalities. But we know what they probably are, and so we can do targeted searches. Thus far, it hasn't borne fruit, but you know, these sorts of things may or may not happen. So we can't quite close the 5 cone, but we know probably what the closure of the 5 cone is. So now that I've said a lot of stuff about these inequalities, maybe I should actually write one down. So the most photogenic of these inequalities is something that I like to call the cyclic inequality, which you'll see why I call that very simply. So this is a new inequality. This is the first new inequality that we were able to show. And this inequality is called the cyclic inequality because the coefficients that we're looking at are, in fact, that the sum of the cyclic 3 terms are greater than or equal to the sum of the cyclic 2 terms plus the 5 term. So you may notice, if you were particularly astute, that if I recall the form of the MMI inequality, this is also a cyclic inequality, where the sum of the cyclic 2 entropies is greater than the sum of the cyclic 1 entropies plus the 3 entropy. And you may wonder whether this inequality can be extended further. And indeed, we've managed to prove that you can, that you in fact find an infinite family of new holographic inequalities, one for every new odd party number. So there's one for the three-party case, for the five-party case, for the seven-party case, where the form is exactly what you would expect. Where the sum of the k-party entropies is greater than or equal to the sum, sorry, these are cyclic, of the k minus 1 party entropies plus the 2k minus 1 entropy. So this inequality is also always true for any holographic system. It's kind of cool. You found an infinite family of inequalities. Or, I mean, I think it's cool. You guys have to tell me if you think it's cool. So you can prove that this inequality is true. There are other inequalities. They're even longer and have uglier coefficients in front of them. So I'm going to...
Those are truly new.
Huh?
They're not just...
Those are truly new. That's right.
And this one has a very simple geometry. So...
Yeah. Well, this one has a very simple geometry if you, for example, work on if you only have one boundary and you partition the boundary exactly. But if you have a multi-boundary configuration, it's not as clear. But yes, I agree that this has...
The other ones
are less structured. But actually, that's an interesting point, which I think I'll talk about a little bit more in detail now that you mention it. These inequalities that we look at actually all have interesting group theoretic properties in the sense that this one is, for example, S4 invariant. But because S4 is the same as D8, this is also invariant under the dihedral group. So when Patrick Hayden, when Patrick and collaborators first looked at this inequality, they asked the same flavor of question that we asked, whether this could be generalized to an infinite family. But what they did is they tried to maintain the S symmetry as opposed to the D symmetry. So what they asked is whether basically alternating signed sums of the k entropies had a definite sign, and they found that it did not. But I guess the thing that led them astray is that the important symmetry here is not the S symmetry, but rather the cyclic symmetry. So once you come here, you see that it's promoted to the 10-party, to D10. So you can actually show that these all have, it's actually pretty trivial to show that all of these have d to the 4k minus 2 symmetry. So you find this group structure among these things. And then actually, if you look at the other inequalities, even though they're uglier, they also have similar group structure. So it's reasonable to conjecture that we haven't shown this one way or the other, that what actually happens as you go up is that there's some chain of minimal overgroups for the permutation invariance of these inequalities, such that if you start from one of these inequalities, that the minimal overgroup along some chain will take you to another inequality, and then the minimal overgroup of that in a similar way will take you to yet a third inequality. And that would be a much better way of searching for further candidate inequalities than...
Also, this whole thing suggests that if you go to more parties, you're going to get bigger groups.
That's right.
Bigger representations.
Yeah, that's right.
More inequalities, not all of them.
Yeah, that's right. You expect a branching tree. You don't expect just... you expect it to branch. Yeah, I don't know how else to say that. But, well, we don't know. Well, we already have an infinite number of inequalities just with these two. But we haven't proven the further ones. So this is that the statement that I just made is a conjecture that we haven't managed to demonstrate one way or another because, in part, slicing six-party Hamming distances ends up being computationally expensive. So at this point, I'm going to try to answer the question that you asked earlier, where you were asking whether these inequalities are true for systems outside of holography. And how much time do you? Okay, good. So whether or not these systems are true, whether or not these inequalities are true for systems outside holography. So these inequalities are, in a sense, not very holographic in the sense that the only thing that I use to prove these inequalities is this inclusion-exclusion condition. So this inclusion-exclusion condition does not actually require full holography. It just requires something that I can minimize over. In holography, that the feature that you're minimizing over are, in fact, these surfaces, these minimal surfaces, given to you by the Ryutaki-Inagi formula. But for example, in condensed matter physics, You can think about other systems that give you different minimization properties. And the specific systems that I'm thinking about are systems that possess an area law in condensed matter physics. So if you have systems that have an area law in condensed matter physics, what you can do is you can show that many of these inequalities are trivially saturated for systems with an exact area law. And then the corrections thereupon from subleading terms to the area law are the interesting quantum corrections. So what you end up seeing is that the area law terms trivially cancel in this case, and you can ask for further effects at subleading order that probably violate these inequalities. Now, this is a general philosophy, however, because for the area law, it's trivial. For holography, it's not. It's not clear that every other possible minimization criteria that I'll consider will be like the area law and not like holography. So at this point, you can ask what other quantum systems have their entanglement entropies related to some parameter that is being minimized over. And if you can find such a parameter, and if that parameter is well behaved, then these inequalities should also be true for all of those systems. So does that answer the question that you had earlier?
I think so. I'm happy.
Okay. Let's see. So that's what we did. Thank you very much.
Turun mentioned the Lorentz invariant theories have additional inequalities. How do those,
Do you want to?
The inequality from reflection positivity just bypasses Cassini's work. So
you have like some five-party inequalities or something?
He was looking at two or three five, depending on how you think of the Western system. So region A, B, and C is the Western system. And he just follows from reflection positivity of correlation functions. Mm-hmm. And you can think of any entropy as a correlation function on the two copies of the system. So you can apply any reflection positivity on just two copies of the system, which is trace row squared is the expectation value of star operator.
Are those contained in the holographic?
No, they are nonlinear.
They're nonlinear.
Oh, they're nonlinear.
They can't be. So, in fact, you can think of these inequalities, or the condition of Lorentz invariance that Tarun talks about, as a further constraint, much as you can think of holography as a further constraint on top of the set of quantum inequalities, which shrinks the cone. But his inequality shrinks it in a different way, in a nonlinear way. In fact, you see the same thing for specific restrictions of holography. So this is interesting because this is work that I did with Sepper Nizami at Stanford, and in fact, an undergraduate who did a summer undergraduate research fellowship with me at Caltech. If you restrict to the case of considering a single boundary CFT, you run into certain situations where, because you know the exact Cardi-Calabrese form of the entanglement entropies, you can show certain nonlinear constraints to the entanglement entropy. If I can remember how this works, it looks something like is less than or equal to SA plus some log of 1 plus e to the SB. You get inequalities of this type that come from the restriction to a single boundary. This is related to the fact that if you actually look for extremal rays with a single boundary, in general you can't find them because it's difficult to get the finite piece and the infinite pieces to match at the same time. So for a single boundary, the infinite piece just scales as the number of endpoints. So you can actually very quickly prove a no-go theorem that for the vast majority of extremal rays, they can't occur in a single boundary, which is in part why we focus so much on these multi-boundary cases for which the graph theory is useful. And the reason for that is because if we consider surfaces for which the Ryu-Takayanagi surface for entire boundaries are just circles in the bulk, those don't have boundary terms, so we only need to fix the finite terms to be equal to each other, and we don't need to care about the infinite contribution. So you get things like this, and then if you remember high school mathematics, or I guess more precisely high school math competitions, you have you might remember a theorem called Ptolemy's theorem for cyclic quadrilaterals, which tells you that the product of the diagonals is equal to the sum of the products of the opposing sides. So it turns out that this has a generalization to hyperbolic space that was worked out by some mathematician from Alabama like 30 years ago. But the hyperbolic extension of Ptolemy's theorem replaces this simple relationship with cinches. But if we remember that the geodesics in Ptolemy's theorem, that the geodesics in hyperbolic space with a single boundary correspond exactly to the entanglement entropies, you can actually see an exact equality that's given by a fully partitioned single boundary like this, where you can, for example, if you know 5 of the entanglement entropies, you know the remainder, and you can calculate it in that way. In general, it's not very simple to calculate this way, but it's kind of a cute thing that my undergrad found, along with Sepper's help, that you can do with a single dimension. And this comes from further constraints. This is also a nonlinear sort of thing that you can see. Any other questions?
So if you have these nonlinear inequalities, doesn't that mean that you're sort of trying to find some linear inequality that kind of sits, you know, it's sort of trying to fit tightly around some nonlinear thing? And
right,
won't that mean that you won't be able to construct some, right?
Yeah, so remember that these nonlinear inequalities that I describe are for specifically the set of holographic theories that have a single boundary. So this is a subset of the full holographic cone. So it's like a dome, if you will, that sits inside of the cone.
I see. But you don't know of any nonlinear inequalities that might apply more generally.
No.
It's like Cassini. You know, some of like Cassini's nonlinear inequalities might be such a thing.
They might be. I should look into that. True.
I heard from Mukund. I think it's published that if I have a sufficiently complicated system, like he studied like few qubit system with certain random interaction perhaps, and then he found that I3, whatever this mutual, the first one in the interaction term, that always holds. So that's some kind of suggestion that systems which are sufficiently complicated or chaotic may satisfy these. Is that
right? So I think what he finds is that it holds for the vast majority of such systems, and that as you take the number of systems to infinity, the fraction of systems for which it holds goes to 1. That's what you mean.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but has someone checked these ones also for the similar? So if I go down, the second one which you wrote for, has someone done that calculation for your second, like this for this whole series?
Right. So So I gave this talk at Perimeter, and I think that was the first that McKinn heard about this, and that was after he'd written this first paper, and he seemed interested in doing something along those lines, but I believe at the time, at least, he had not yet done so.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank you again.